Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Trades Hall tonight. I'm Harry Burns, chair for this evening. And those of you who have been regular attenders of this series of lectures will remember, I'm sure, the lectures given by Bruce McCune and Liz Gould, who introduced us to the idea that the way in which young animals and young humans experience the world very early on in their life shapes the way their brain is structured, and from that flows a number of consequences for the physiology, for their psychological, social and physical health in later life. And tonight we're very honoured to have with us Michael Meaney, who is the James McGill Professor in the Departments of Psychiatry, Neurology and Neurosurgery at the University of McGill, McGill University in Montreal. Now that of course gives him a strong link with Glasgow, because James McGill was a student at Glasgow University. He only ever lasted a couple of years, and I wonder if he flunked, you know, but he certainly made a great success in his time in Canada. The other interesting thing is that if you search Michael on Google, your first name that comes up is Michael Meaney. The next name that comes up is really very interesting. It says, Michael Meaney, contact Michael Meaney at supermodels.com. Available for commercial and glamour photography. I thought he's a very interesting guy, this, but it then goes on to say, more of her photographs can be found at such and such a place. I didn't follow that link. But clearly Michael is a name that's much more versatile in North America than it is here. So Michael's going to talk to us tonight about maternal care and the interactions between genes and environments.
Thank you. Can you hear me? You can? No? No, it's, I guess... You know, maybe I will. You're going to regret this. Good. Can you come in here? Harry, if you've gone to those pictures, And there's actually a couple of secretaries who have been handling invitations for seminars like this who have done that. And they've been horribly disappointed to find that the first Michael Meaney and the second Michael Meaney are two distinct human beings. The second Michael Meaney features in new modeling. Well, you can imagine, it's nothing. Much that my CV would be tremendously more interesting and invitations more plentiful if they were the same. The other thing about James McGill that might go to addressing the question that makes it interesting being a James McGill professor is that on the campus of McGill University, James McGill is a drinking song. That might feature in the history of James McGill. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here, and thank you to Harry, to Andrew for the invitation. And what I'm trying to do with this lecture is to leave you with something a little bit different, something that you may not have been aware of when you came through the doors. And in particular, what I want to do is to pick up on a conversation that Andrew and I had yesterday. We were talking about where trends have gone and how people understand and interpret not only psychopathology, but themselves. And that was, of course, the old nature-nurture conflict. The nature-nurture conflict had two manifestations. I think one of those manifestations was in the issue of hereditary and inheritance. And probably its oldest manifestation was to simply be used in some way to justify the passage of resources from one generation to another, independent of the individuals who were actually at the other end of the inheritance. And so we spoke of birthrights, and we basically justified that in some way through inheritance and came to understand the gene as being, if you will, a biological rationale for it. Which is interesting because because we had, what was interesting in the history of biochemistry was we had defined the gene long before Weber discovered DNA, which was very interesting because what it means today is that many of us walk around with an understanding of what a gene is that has actually no relationship to what it really is. Instead, our notions of what genes are and what they do were formed by those preconceived issues. And the nature-nurture conflict, in fact, embodies them. Because what people do is they speak about genes and environment in some ways as if they were two independent forces that could, in fact, biologically, realistically operate independent of each other. And that we could then think of the construction of individuals on our planet as being, to some extent, influenced by this force, and to some extent influenced by that force. And that whole notion has been reinforced by some of the unfortunate research trends where people will say, your ability to lightly brown chicken on a barbecue is 13% environment and 80% genetic. You know, those notions, as I say, are interesting because they live and breathe within our science and our culture without really any reference to what genes really are or how they really operate. Now, the second way we can think about gene-environment interactions, of course, is that we can also try to dissociate biological forces, whatever we might mean from that, from social forces. And so, for example, I know one of the questions that people speak about here in Glasgow, and Andrew and I and Harry and I have spoken about, of course, is the influence of poverty. Right? And here, for example, there was a great resistance to think that biology could have any reference whatsoever in this debate, because clearly we were talking about forces and influences that are social and economic. And so where Andrew and I were trying to go with our conversation is to understand what has transpired with that discussion. How have we managed in any way to move beyond those rather stultifying versions of defining what we are? And what we came with, and I think Andrew put his finger on it when he said that the group of researchers that he leads and consults are people who take a psychosocial biological approach. And clearly this is implying that there's some integration that's occurring here between the social understanding of the world and the biological understanding of the world. And that's what I want to try to underscore tonight. And I want to try to suggest that in fact, ironically, the more we understand about genes and how they operate, the better able we are to appreciate how critical environmental influences are in understanding our biology. Now, I cleverly took off my jacket. Which holds the critical piece of cardboard that I need. Now, what I want to start us off with is really just some basic principle, a basic principle about development. When we think about development, the best word in understanding the whole term development is that of adaptation. Understanding biology, every component of it, whether we're talking about the development of a muscle cell, a fat cell, or a brain cell, think of it as a process of adaptation. It is a manifestation of our genome. Our genes are being activated by environmental signals. And the dialogue between those events is actually adaptive in nature and determining the outcomes. So muscle cells develop in relation to nutrient supply that we experience during prenatal development and postnatal development, as do bone cells, as do fat cells. And brain cells, of course, adapt to a far more diverse array of events. In part, we can characterize these events as being economic. They're economic in the sense that they require access to nutrients, they require shelter and safety and security from infections. They are economic, and that is no less true for a developing plant than it is for a human being. And they are social. In every organism on this planet, there is at least a maternal influence. And that influence is going to obviously be manifested in very different ways depending on the species that we study. But nevertheless, we can always think of adaptation as occurring at least in part to a social event, to a parental influence in some way. Now, we can take that very simple axiom of biology and see it living and breathing within many of the studies that are emerging from social epidemiology. We know, for example, that the chances of us developing any of these particular chronic diseases is statistically associated or predicted by the quality of our early family life. And so we know that individuals who undergo trauma in the form of physical or sexual abuse, emotional neglect, harsh and inconsistent discipline, that each of these individuals is more likely to develop these forms of chronic illness. Now, intuitively, of course, you're going to think, well, that makes sense when we think in terms of psychopathology. The interesting thing to consider is it's no less true if you're talking about diabetes, heart disease, or, in fact, obesity. Indeed, for those who thumb through the pages of epidemiological studies, the odds ratio here might be greatest in terms of obesity. So our health is shaped, at least it would seem, in part, by the social forces that define the family environment. And a question we can ask then is, how does this happen? How could the quality of early family life influence the developing organism so as to bias them either in favor of these particular diseases or a better quality of life? And one of the emerging hypotheses is the following. This hypothesis, which is very much a work in progress at this stage, suggests that what occurs is that early in life, the quality of the family environment influences the nature of individual differences in the way that our brain and endocrine systems respond to stress. And that these individual differences in defensive responses, if you will, in turn predict individual differences in these disorders. Now, this model is based in part from studies of years in clinical medicine and physiology, which have suggested that the hormones our body produces during periods of stress can actively promote each of these particular diseases. And this is a theme, I think, if you were here when Bruce McEwen spoke, that he would have addressed in great detail. What is also emerging in human studies, as well as in studies with our own human species, is evidence that, in fact, these forms of early experience can shape these individual differences in stress reactivity, in the likelihood of our body activating these stress responses in relation to the slings and arrows of everyday life. And it's this part of the hypothesis that I'm really going to focus on in the course of tonight's lecture. But let's take this model one step further, because I think if we take it logically and pursue this, there's a real way of being able to fit this model into many of the discussions that are primary to those individuals within Scotland. And that is, of course, that when we look at this particular relationship, we understand right away that neither these forms of chronic illness, neither these forms of chronic illness nor these forms of early family dysfunction are randomly distributed across the population, that both are more likely to occur in individuals who have grown up under conditions of poverty. And it is not at all hard to imagine how the distress of poverty compromises the health and well-being of parents so as to encourage this form of interaction between parents and children, and thus to initiate this particular cascade. Now that's, as I said, very much a working hypothesis. I'm going to show you some evidence in favor of it in the following slides, but I'll argue that one of the things I really like about this particular model is it provides a bridge between individuals who look at the social determinants of health and those who study its biological underpinnings, because both can be found encompassed within this particular working model. Okay, the other thing that has emerged over the course of, I'd say, about the 1990s and then more recently in some more intensive studies, is the idea that, in fact, we can indeed understand the effects of poverty with respect to many of these particular outcomes by appealing to the idea that the effects of poverty are mediated through the functioning of the family. And this has come from studies by people like Conger, McCoy, Lake, Eisenberg, and others, who have suggested family mediation. And I'll just show you one example of a slightly more recent study that I think clearly shows this. This is a study by Lindbergh, Brooks, Dunn, and Cohen, published a few years ago in Developmental Psychology, in which they use statistical modeling to understand the link between poverty and childhood behavioral problems. And what they found out with their modeling was that, in fact, the relationship between poverty and childhood behavior was mediated not only by individual differences in parent-offspring interaction, but more proximally by the level of emotional distress suffered by the mother. And in fact, at that same time, our group had published some work showing that levels of cortisol, a stress hormone in children, were actually predicted by exactly the same model. That essentially what is occurring then is that the distress of poverty works through the emotional and mental health of the parent to influence parenting, which in turn then describes effects or explains effects at the level of childhood behavioral problems. If you start looking at other dimensions of child development, you see some interesting features here. In fact, the relationship between poverty and child cognitive development was not described necessarily so strongly by differences in parent-offspring interaction. Rather, it was described by a difference in the quality of the home environment, the degree to which the home environment provided cognitive stimulation for the child. But in any case, in essence, what we're talking about are a raft of studies that suggest that environmental adversity imposed on the home environment leads to changes in parenting as well as in the quality of resources within the home, and that these factors in turn lead to changes in child development. Now, none of this, I suspect, is a surprise to any of you, right? The interesting feature to all of this is that we can take exactly the same theme and find it living and breathing within the literature of evolutionary biology. And this is not a literature in which people are studying the development of human children. It is a literature in which they are studying the development of insects, reptiles, and simpler organisms. And the model that emerges here is one that speaks to a phenomenon known as maternal or parental effects. And this model, which describes work across an enormous range of species, suggests that the quality of the prevailing environment in terms of nutrient supply, levels of infection and predation, that all of those signals alter the level of parental investment in the young. That's true of insects, it's true of reptiles, it's even true of plants. And that this level of parental investment then signals the developing offspring and shapes these developmental outcomes. Again, the interesting thing is, that's the same model we were talking about in discussing poverty. In other words, when we actually appeal to these type of mediational models, we're not suggesting something that's esoteric, unique to human psychology. We're talking about something that is a common principle across all forms of development on the planet. It is, if you will, a biological reality. So I thought I'd give you just a few examples. Now, in each case, what we're talking about in the studies that describe this work is how exposure of the parental offspring to some form of adversity, and in the examples I'm going to show you, that's risk for predation, that it somehow alters parent-offspring interactions in ways we don't clearly understand, that program individual differences in defensive responses in the offspring. Let me give you the first example. These are skinks, small reptiles, very common in deserted areas in Australia, and also very popular amongst the local snake population, right, in the sense of food. So snakes prey heavily on these skinks. The skinks that are the most frequently preyed upon are those that are physically smaller, have shorter tails, easier to ingest, and are less reactive to the cues of snakes, so they're not as quick to run away and evade the snake. Those are the ones, that's the profile, if you will, of a skink that's most likely to meet its demise by way of predation. The interesting thing is, if you take the mother skink and you simply expose her to the scent of a predatory snake, then the offspring are born larger, with longer tails, and behaviorally are more likely to evade and escape from snakes. You've changed completely the development of these skinks by simply exposing the mother to a queue of predators in her life. Right? Take you to another example, and this one takes us even further into this model because it speaks about transgenerational effects. These are water flakes, and know, even in Canada, water fleas do not emerge to this particular size. Okay? This is a scanning electron micrograph of what you would always imagine a water flea look like. Under benign optimal conditions, that is, in a laboratory aquarium with no predators, these water fleas take this ovular process right here. That's what they look like. However, if you then transfer an adult water flea out of this aquarium and you put it into an aquarium, into water that has previously been occupied by a predator, then what happens in response to the sense of this predator is that these water fleas grow these horned helmets and longer spiny tails. It makes them harder to ingest. And physically what happens is these guys are more likely to evade a predator or to escape predation than are these more delectable tidbits on the ground. So you've got an inducible defense. It's a great idea, right? So moms don't have to run worrying about, you know, the metabolic costs associated with this defense. But if the predator scent is there, they show this change, a massive change in morphology. So what Ralph Tollerant did, who's in Germany, is that he took adult female water fleas that were all born in these benign aquaria, no predators around, transferred half of them into an aquarium that had been previously occupied by a predator. They then showed this massive helmet, the long spiny tails, and then he took them and transferred them back into the controlled environment and allowed them to reproduce. And what he found was that the offspring of those mothers who had been exposed to the predator were born with larger helmets than with those born to mothers who had never been exposed to the predator. As they matured into adulthood in the absence of the predator, the helmet size shrank in both cases but remained substantially larger in this group. But then if you expose them to the sense of a predator, these guys show a much greater inducible defense. In other words, by simply exposing the parental organism to adversity in early life, you had changed the development of the offspring. So we're looking at a very common theme here. Our question really here is simple. We want to try to understand how it is that this might occur. How is it that the context within which parenting occurs can biologically become embedded so as to alter the development of the infant and thus their health and productivity over the course of their lifespan? And what I'm going to suggest to you in a series of studies is that, in fact, the variations in parental care that derive from environmental adversity literally alter the structure and activity of genes in the brain of the offspring that regulate the way in which they respond to stress, and that these same effects also impinge upon neural development. That the way in which this environmental force operates upon the genome involves a level of plasticity at the level of the DNA that is referred to as epigenetics. So let me tell you just a little bit of background as to how you might want to think about this. For most of us, we don't walk around thinking regularly about how it is that the molecules inside our cells behave, right? We think of them as somehow molecules. They exist within cells, they do their thing, right? So you make a particular hormone or a peptide, it does its thing, and off it goes. And of course, as you can probably appreciate, the biochemistry of that is very different. That molecules, including DNA, have a structure, right? So they can exist in a linear form or folded out. And that structure has an awful lot to do with the way they behave. What I want to tell you is that these epigenetic modifications that refer to plasticity at the level of DNA are forms of influence that alter the structure and thus the behavior of the genes. And what I'm going to tell you is that that, in fact, can be signaled by the quality of parental care. Okay, so this is really a pretty interesting problem in a sense, and in a way we can all anticipate that some process like this has to occur, even at the level of the DNA, because we know that even when we talk about monozygotic twins who share exactly the same genome, is that they can actually turn out to be rather different. Okay? So you notice these two characters who are in fact perfectly identical monozygotic twins who share exactly the same nuclear genes. Well, life has somehow impinged upon Fred and Phil in a way that has caused them to become notably different in adulthood, right? And in ways that exceed simply that of one holding their beer can heavier than the other. We imagine that somehow environmental forces could produce this level of diversity, and what we want to try to understand is how that can actually happen. So what I'm going to do is to spend a little bit of time introducing you to the topic of epigenetics, what it means to structurally modify genes, and then I'm going to give you some experimental examples of how we think that can actually happen. So first of all, how to think about epigenetics. Well, we're all familiar with particular metaphors that refer to DNA. In fact, we commonly refer to the DNA as a genetic code. Now, there's weaknesses associated with that particular metaphor, but in large measure, what we're actually saying is that the nucleotide sequence that is characteristic of the genome determines the products of the genome. It determines, for example, which RNAs or which proteins are produced from that particular sequence. That's a level of information, and that information is defined by nucleotide sequence. That's only one level of information contained on mature DNA. The second level of information is epigenetic information. That is a level of information that is chemical in origin, and it is superimposed on the DNA. And so what you're looking at here is the one form of epigenetic mark that is going to be the subject of this lecture, and that is simply the addition of a methyl group onto cytosines. It is, in fact, very much a Scottish topic, since the world leader on this topic is actually Adrian Bird at the University of Edinburgh. So for many years, we've known that, in fact, you can modify the activity of DNA by adding particular chemical marks onto various sites, and in mammalian DNAs, the only nucleotide in which that occurs is cytosines. Now let me tell you a bit then, first of all, one thing to understand when we're talking here is that we are in fact speaking about two specific forms of information. For example, adding these methyl groups onto DNA does not change the sequence. The underlying sequence remains unaltered. What changes is the level of activity of that region of the DNA. So epigenetics, by definition, is any functional change in the DNA genome that does not involve the alterations of sequence. And so what we're talking about, again, are these chemical signals superimposed on the DNA. Okay, so here is where things get a little detailed. And obviously, it's not my intent to burden you with the details of this information, but rather to simply walk you through a little bit about how it is that DNA operates and why it is that environmental signals are so critical to the operation of the genome. Okay, so epigenetic effects refer to modifications of the chemistry or the chemical environment in which the DNA operates. Epigenetic alterations alter the activity of the gene. What they do, in fact, is determine how active this nucleotide is in producing proteins or RNAs. The DNA methylation that we're speaking about right here is simply the addition of a methyl moiety onto particular nucleotides, cytosines. DNA methylation is chemically very stable, potentially. And so the interesting thing about this is that if you modify the DNA in this way, that potentially can actually last throughout the entire lifespan of the organism. And DNA methylation alters the activity of a gene. And now what I want to do is tell you a little bit about how that occurs. So again, I mentioned to you that structure in biochemistry is important, that it determines the operation of molecules. And I'm going to give you an example of this, particularly with relation to DNA. So if we pick up common literature on DNA, it's often graphically portrayed as if a DNA molecule is simply linear and passive, and it has these various signals impinging upon it. And the truth of the matter is very, very different. Here is the way, this is simply Ruger's classic crystallography. This is the way DNA exists in the real world. What you have is the DNA helix, literally 145 to 150 base pairs, and it's wrapped around the protein core. Okay? And in the default condition, this is a very tight configuration. configuration. That DNA is wrapped tightly around the histone protein. Now, why the hell should you care? You should care in terms of this discussion, because when it's in this configuration, DNA is really inactive. It's not doing very much. Right? In fact, if you want your DNA to do something, you need to remodel this configuration. The reason for that is that DNA is activated by particular protein signals known as transcription factors. They simply drive the transcription of the DNA. They cause the DNA to produce RNAs and proteins. If you've got your DNA wrapped tightly around the histones, these transcription factors cannot physically interact with the DNA. Now, what you need to do then is to somehow open up this configuration so that the DNA sites can then interact with these transcription factors. Where those modifications occur is actually on these histone proteins, not on the cores that reside inside, but rather on these amino acid tails that protrude outside of the DNA itself. And they're subject to all kinds of chemical modifications. The most commonly known modification is that called acetylation, in which you simply take a lysine, an amino acid on this histone tail, you apply an acetyl group to it, and what that does is to neutralize the positive charge of the histone proteins, opening up chromatin. Now the transcription factors can interact with the DNA, and the gene can be actively transcribed. How's that? Is that reasonably clear? Yeah? It can't be that hard, or biochemists would never figure it out, but you know, for the most part, the thing to keep in mind is you've got to work on the DNA if you want it to do anything that's sensible. And the way you do that, in part, is by opening up these histone tails, by acetylating these histones. Now, the question you might then pose is, well, how does the methylation of DNA interfere with this particular process? Well, what happens is that when you methylate regions of the DNA, add these methyl groups onto them, you attract a protein. The protein is known as a methylated DNA binding protein. It literally interacts physically with the DNA at sites that are methylated. And it brings a whole bunch of friends to the party. One of these is known, a class of proteins known as histone deacetylases. What histone deacetylases do is they kick off the acetyl groups and they prevent them from reattaching on these histone tails. What that means is that you're now biasing this whole process to a closed configuration. Because if you cannot acetylate these histone tails, you cannot open up chromatin, and the transcription factors cannot bind to those cells. So these histone deacetylases then mediate the effect of DNA methylation. Methylate the DNA, attract these enzymes, they prevent chromatin from opening up, and they bias you towards silencing gene transcription. If you made it through this far, you've made it through probably the technically most difficult part. And I think for the most part, the thing to keep in mind then, primarily, is to think of DNA as an actively regulated molecule. In part, its own methylation status is being part of that same. So, finally we get to some studies. This, in fact, has been our working hypothesis. We have, in fact, proposed the idea that individual differences in parent-offspring interaction lead to changes in epigenetic marks on specific regions of the DNA. And in particular, we suggest these changes involve DNA methylation. That the changes in the epigenetic marks then lead to changes in the ability of genes to actively transcribe particular proteins, and thus to differences in more complex levels of phenotypes or traits, such as stress responses. And for the most part, the research I'm going to take you through has been done with this wonderful organism here, which is a rat. Not a mouse, a rat. And these are, the reason I make that distinction is these are intensely social animals who are used to growing up with an extremely complex social network. And of course, the linchpin for this social development is that of the mother. What you're looking at here, in fact, of course, is a mother nursing her many offspring. And what you see right here is this licking behavior that the mother imparts upon the offspring during a lick and nursing bout. And what we do, first and foremost, is to simply try to characterize naturally occurring individual differences in mother-offspring interaction. And to do this, we literally spend about 6 to 8 hours per day watching mothers interact with their offspring, characterizing the frequency of this licking behavior. And what we find, and this is where, if you will, the bottom line of it take you, is that these naturally occurring variations in maternal care, this licking behavior in particular, programs the expression of genes in the brain that regulate stress responses, thus giving rise to stable individual differences in stress reactivity. And the way in which maternal care regulates the expression of these genes is through these epigenetic modifications. So, maternal licking. Why would we focus on the licking behavior of the mother? Well, we've known for many years that, in fact, physiology and the cardiovascular activity of the developing pup is, in fact, socially regulated. It's regulated by the mother's licking of her offspring. When mothers lick their pups, it stimulates the development, it stimulates the activity of the pituitary somatotrophic system, which produces hormones like growth hormone. It also suppresses hormones that would otherwise inhibit growth, such as glucocorticoids. So the mother's licking is actively driving the physiology of the pup in favor of greater somatic growth. That's what's occurring in an immediate context. Our question is, do these individual differences in the licking behavior have anything to do with the long-term outcomes in terms of these individual pups? So, we look at variations in maternal care. We study them daily over the first 10 days of life, and we find that the frequency of this licking behavior is actually normally distributed across the population. That in fact, some mothers lick their pups about 2 to 3 times as frequently as do other mothers. And those are the ones upon which we focus our studies. So we statistically define these high and low licking mothers, and what we do then is to study their offspring well into adulthood. So we're doing what many developmentalists have done before us. We're characterizing a certain difference in the level of environmental experience at one stage in life, in this case involving maternal care, and studying its offspring and its outcomes in adulthood. And in particular, what I'm going to focus on for tonight's talk is I'm going to talk about how it is that maternal care shapes the development of individual differences in stress responses. Now, to understand that, I'm going to give you just a little bit of background in how it is that the brain of a rat, much like the brain of a human, activates a stress response. The critical brain region, probably in the activation of a stress response, is this area here known as the amygdala. The amygdala is largely a brain region that exists in the limbic system, the older part of the temporal cortex, in which the region is specified to alert the system when any suggestion of threat is presented to the organism. So the activation of the amygdala coincides with the activation of the stress response. Fortunately, the activation of these responses is subject to the influence of brain regions like the hippocampus and the prefrontal cortex that can modulate the activity of the hippocampus, the amygdala, and thus modulate the degree to which the organism responds by mobilizing the stress response. And when you talk about individual differences in stress reactivity, whether you're talking about the rat or the human, for the most part, these individual differences lie in brain structures like the hippocampus and the prefrontal cortex that modulate and generally tend to inhibit these stress responses. In talking about the stress response, for the most part, in the initial part of the talk, I'm going to focus largely on the endocrine branch of the stress response. The way it is that our body produces stress hormones, as we call them, during a period of stress. Now, I'll give you just, first of all, a little bit of the anatomy and then a more systematic description of this system. The way we activate a stress hormone response is basically mediated through one of the oldest areas, perhaps the oldest area in the limbic brain, known as the hypothalamus. So stressful signals impinge from the amygdala down to the hypothalamus, where they cause the hypothalamus to release a hormone known as corticotropin releasing factor. This is CRF, and it is probably the master stress hormone. It is, in fact, when activated, responsible for increases in cardiovascular activity, changes in digestion, changes in emotional well-being, as well as the activation of stress hormones. Corticotropin-releasing factor is then transmitted to the pituitary, where it causes the activation of an intermediate peptide hormone known as adrenocorticotropin hormone, or ACTH. ACTH then acts on the adrenal glands, and the adrenal glands release glucocorticoids, which are a signature of a stress response. They are the major stress hormone. So in essence, what occurs then is that stressful signals impinge on the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus releases this corticotropin-releasing factor into the pituitary. The pituitary gland releases ACTH, which causes the adrenals to release glucocorticoids, and boom, you have a stress response. Now, one of the ways in which this system is modulated is a classic feature of endocrinology that we call negative feedback. That is, the end product of the system, the glucocorticoids, travel in the bloodstream. They act very quickly on the pituitary and the hypothalamus to arrest these signals. That is, they mute or dampen CRF and ACTH. Tonically, over a longer period of time, these same hormones act outside the hypothalamus on brain structures that then regulate the sensitivity of the system. So glucocorticoids, for example, will interact with a receptor protein on hippocampal brain cells. And the net effect of the interaction of the steroid, the glucocorticoids, with this glucocorticoid receptor is to inhibit the production of CRF. The more you inhibit the production of CRF, the more you dampen the HPA response to stress. Clear enough? Sure? Okay. Tortured you enough. Here's something that was interesting. When I was training early on in science, we discovered that, in fact, the more glucocorticoid receptors that are made within the hippocampus, the greater the ability of this negative feedback signal to inhibit CRF. And so animals that produce more of these glucocorticoid receptors have a more efficient ability to inhibit CRF and thus to dampen their pituitary adrenal responses to stress. Animals that produce fewer of these glucocorticoid receptors, the inhibitory signal is not as effective, and these animals show greater production of CRF and thus a greater stress response. So all we're saying here is that the signal is greater, the inhibition of the pituitary adrenal stress response is greater, and that's important because it is exactly this difference that describes the adult offspring animals of mothers who are high lickers versus those who are low lickers. If you take an adult male or female offspring who was raised by a high licking mother, they produce more of these glucocorticoid receptors. They are better able to constrain the production of CRF, and thus they produce more modest stress responses. In contrast, animals that are raised by low licking mothers produce fewer of these glucocorticoid receptors. They are less capable of inhibiting CRF, and thus they show a greater response to stress. The key here is the difference in the activity of the gene that produces the glucocorticoid receptor. It's more active in animals that are raised by high compared to low lipid mothers, and thus the stress response is different. And just to show you that graphically, this is the glucocorticoid response to stress in an animal raised by a high-licking mother. In the black circles, you see the stress response in an animal that was raised by a low-licking mother. They differ in stress reactivity. And the reason they differ in stress reactivity is because the gene that produces the glucocorticoid receptor in the hippocampus is more active in animals reared by high-licking mothers than in animals reared by low-licking mothers. You have a social modulation of a gene that produces a receptor that regulates the way in which the animals respond to stress. And of course, you can ask all kinds of questions about this particular finding. One of the questions that you can ask, for example, is that, well, is this really due to the mother? Right? Is it really the mother's behavior, the licking behavior per se, that's driving the differences in the glucocorticoid receptor gene? And we can answer that question by doing what is a fairly simple, albeit labor-intensive experiment. We can do adoption studies. We we can take animals that are born to low-living mothers, the biological offspring of a low-living dam, and transfer them right after birth onto an animal that we know to be a high-living mother. And vice versa, we can take animals that are born to high-living mothers and foster them onto loves. And when we do that study, we completely reverse the phenotypes. So we know that it's the mother's behavior. And studies from our lab and other labs have shown that, in fact, the tactile stimulation associated with the mother's licking is what's critical to trials. So it is, in fact, the mother's licking that's producing these differences in the reproductive perception. The question then is, how does that happen? How does a social event regulate the activity of a gene? First question. And second question, how is it that once these pups have grown up, we moved away from don't write, don't call, except when they need money, that somehow that effect persists, right? That they continue to produce those differences in the reproductive. Well, what I'm going to do first of all is to walk you through just a little bit of how this happens. And again, the details here are not critical. But essentially, you want to know how can licking behavior, which is a social event, alter the activity of a hippocampal brain cell so that it produces more of these glucocorticoid receptors. So the first challenge, of course, is you want to find that critical signal that links the behavior of the mother to the cell itself, this extracellular signal. What kind of neurotransmitter neurochemical event is directly modulated by the care of the mother? Once you get inside the cell, you then want to know how the signal is actually transduced into a set of molecules that directly interact with the DNA itself. And here's the answer to how that occurs. Essentially what happens is that when the mother licks the pup, it increases sympathetic activity. Okay, so it increases the activity and the output from sympathetic nerve systems so that you get more adrenaline produced by the pup. The adrenaline works on actually a store of fat, brown fat tissues, and it causes the brown fat cells to take a particular hormone, the thyroid hormone, and to produce higher levels of a more active variant of the thyroid hormone known as triiodothyroid, or T3. Thyroid hormones affect almost every aspect of development, including that in the brain. And what they do is they act on specific nerves in the brain to cause an increase in the release of neurotransmitter that many of you might know that quite well, and it's called serotonin. Serotonin has multiple effects, particularly within brain structures such as the hippocampus and the prefrontal cortex. And we know that the licking behavior of the mother causes an increase in the release of serotonin. We can also then describe exactly which receptors and which what we call intracellular signaling pathways are activated by the mother's licking and mediated through this effect of serotonin. So that part we can define. Now what we really need to do is to discover what is the transcription factor that links this extracellular serotonin signal to the DNA. And that was, if you will, a major obstacle, and it was overcome when we identified one particular transcription factor known as NGFIA. That's the transcription factor that is affected by serotonin and activated by maternal care. And what makes that a really important event is that we know that this transcription factor, NGFIA, has the ability of directly interacting with DNA. Okay, so it is potentially a signal that could link the social event with that of the genome. And we've shown, for example, that we know that serotonin itself is capable of not only activating NGFIA, but of turning on the glucocorticoid receptor. What we also know is that, in fact, the effects of serotonin are mediated through NGFIA. So if we take some hippocampal cells and we put them into culture dish, and we simply mimic the effects of maternal care by treating those cells with serotonin, whoops, we can cause an increase in the production of the glucocorticoid receptor. And that effect is completely blocked if we disable the cell's ability to produce NGFIA. So NGFIA is the signal that links the mother's licking and the production of serotonin to the increase in the glucocorticoid receptor. And we also know through studies of pups that the mother's licking directly increases the production of NGFIA. So we know that this cascade of events and signals is occurring within the hippocampal neurons when these pups are being licked by their mothers. The next question we have to ask then is, where on the DNA is this NGFIA signal being transmitted? So we can study the mother's influence up to and including the production of NGFIA. Now we want to get to the gene itself, the DNA region itself. So, in fact, these are studies that we're doing in collaboration with a good friend, Jonathan Seppel, at the University of Edinburgh, where what we did was to look at that part of the gene that seemed like the most likely place to look. It's that part of the gene that regulates the activity of the glucocorticoid receptor gene. So when you think of a gene in simplest of terms, you can first of all think of a region of DNA that produces protein. The second region of DNA does not participate in the production of protein. Instead, it contains regulatory elements that determine the level of activity of this part of the gene. And that we consider to be the most common place because we know that the offspring of plovers can make the glucocorticoid receptor gene. They just don't make as much of it. So we figure these regulatory regions are primary where the action is. So what Jonathan's lab and our group did was to clone or describe that part of the glucocorticoid receptor gene that has this regulatory effect. And what we found was that, in fact, there were many sequences of DNA, each of which was perfectly capable of turning on the glucocorticoid receptor gene. Our challenge then was to find which of these regulatory areas, which of these so-called promoters, was active within hippocampal neurons and was regulated by the behavior of the mother. So we find this guy right here. This is actually called 1-7 promoter. And it turns out that it's a small span of DNA that is critical in determining how much glucocorticoid receptor you produce within hippocampal brain cells. And what we then found was that, in fact, this region of DNA, right here, this region of DNA is more active in turning on the glucocorticoid receptor gene if the animal was reared by a high-licking mother compared to a low-licking mother. So now we've got a particular region that we know determines the activity of the glucocorticoid receptor gene, and it's regulated by maternal care. What we then found out, sequence this region of the promoter, is that it contains a region that can physically directly interact with NGFIA. Okay? So think about this. This is a little bit, for us biochemistry geeks, of a eureka moment, right? Because here you've got protein signal that you know is activated by maternal behavior, and here you've got a region of the DNA that can directly interact with that maternal signal. So now what we have is the prospect of being able to define precisely how a social signal is interacting with the DNA. And of course, as I mentioned to you earlier, what we had previously shown was that, yeah, mother's licking turns on NGFIA. These pups reared by high-licking mothers produce more NGFIA. And what we also showed was that, in fact, if you take out hippocampal brain cells of pups who are reared by high or low-licking mothers, is that you can actually find that there is more NGFIA physically interacting with this regulatory sequence in pups reared by high or low-licking moms. There's more of it directly signaling the DNA. And what that does, of course, when it signals this particular promoter, is it turns it on. And it causes the pups to produce more glucocorticoid receptor. So in a nutshell then, what happens is the mother's licking causes an increase in NGFIA that binds to this regulatory 1-7 promoter, turns on the glucocorticoid receptor, and so the pup is making more of this glucocorticoid receptor gene. That's interesting, but it's only part of the problem. And in fact, the main challenge here is really not to understand how the pup in early infancy, raised by a high-licking mother, is making more glucocorticoid receptor. The real challenge is to understand how it is that 2, 4, 6 months later, when the pup is completely removed from its mother, it's still making more of that glucocorticoid receptor. So, part of the problem here is underscored by the fact that, yes, if you look at the brain of infant rats, the amount of NGFIA that they make is indeed regulated by the mother's licking. But in adulthood, that effect is abolished. There's no longer a difference in that NGFIA. So that can't explain why they're making more of these Google protocol sellers. So what we suggested was that could be that the increased interaction of NGFIA with the DNA during early life, in the first week of life, when these animals are developing, that it somehow causes a structural change in the DNA. And that structural change later continues and mediates this particular effect. And the structural change that we talked about and considered was the possibility that it might lead to a difference in DNA methylation. And so what we actively did then was to look at the methylation of this critical region of the DNA that regulates the glucocorticoid receptor. Actually, taking these little bits. Now, here's that particular region. This is the region that physically interacts with NGFIA. And what you'll know, if you look closely enough, is that there's actually two cytosines, two of these Cs, lying within the region that can physically interact with NGFIA. And cytosines can be methylated. And so what we did was to simply take this sequence and ask the question about whether or not the mother's behavior might determine whether either this cytosine or this one here might be methylated in adult. And the answer was yes, it does. So you've got two cytosines. This is just that same sequence that binds NGFIA. That's the part of the promoter that physically interacts with this transcription factor. Two cytosines. One on the right, which we refer to as 3', one on the left, which we call 5'. So we're actually doing studies where we characterize the methylation state of these individual cytosines. We find that this particular cytosine sitting right here, it generally tends to be methylated. It carries that methyl mark, regardless of whether the animal was raised by a higher or weaker mother. Over here, this particular cytosine, in contrast, it is heavily methylated. It carries the methyl mark if the animal was reared by a low-linking mother, but it very rarely carries that methyl mark if the animal was reared by a high-linking mother. The mother's behavior is statistically associated with the difference in the presence or absence of the methyl group on this particular site. Okay, the second thing we can do is to go back to our cross-fostering studies, cross-fostered lows to highs, highs to lows, and show, in fact, that this difference that I showed you right here is entirely driven by the mother's behavior towards the baby. Now, the next question that you can ask is, so what do you have? You've got one single cytosine nucleotide, and it either carries or does not carry this methyl mark. Does that really change anything? Is that really meaningful? So what we did was a whole series of studies in which we asked the question, if the methyl mark is present on this single cytosine, as it so commonly is in animals reared by low-linking mothers, does that alter the ability of NGFIA to physically interact with the site? In contrast, in animals that are reared by high-linking mothers that don't carry the methyl mark, is NGFIA better able to interact with that site? And the answer is yes, that's true. So in a sense, what you're doing by adding this single methyl group onto this site is you're decreasing the ability of NGFIA to physically bind to the DNA and to turn on the glucocorticoid receptor. Fair enough? That's what the mother's behavior is doing. And in fact, what you can then do is to understand why it is then that despite the fact that as adults these animals produce the same amount of NGFIA, they produce different amounts of the glucocorticoid receptor. And the explanation is as follows. If the animal carries the methyl mark at this particular site, even though it makes scads of NGFIA, the NGFIA can't physically interact with that site and cannot turn on the glucocorticoid receptor. And that's what is apparent in the animals reared by low-linking mothers. In contrast, if the animal was reared by a high-linking mother, it does not carry the methyl mark. NGFIA can merrily interact with the site and turn on the glucocorticoid receptor. The behavior of the mother is altering the the ability of this signal to turn on this particular gene. And that, for example, is something that we've given considerable thought in, and there's a great deal of evidence now for exactly that model. We can, in fact, go back experimentally, reverse this difference in methylation, and completely reverse the differences in the glucocorticoid receptor production and the way in which these animals respond to stress. In fact, that's what was on these slides, which I will spare you. I'm going to take you through just two quick messages, because I think I'm starting to get a little time challenged. The first question is, well, how does this happen? How, in fact, does maternal care alter the methylation of this particular cytosine? Now, I took you through this particular schema, so you'll be relieved to know you've already seen it. And what I'm telling you here is simply that, yes, maternal behavior causes a whole series of signals occurring outside as well as inside these hippocampal cells, and that the critical signal for the activation of the glucocorticoid receptor is the ability of NGFIA to physically interact with this glucocorticoid receptor site. And what I'm going to tell you is, in fact, that the research strongly suggests that it's exactly the increased interaction of NGFIA with the genome in early life that produces the difference in DNA methylation. And the way that seems to happen was a bit of a surprise to us. What you're looking at here, remember I told you that the difference all occurs on one single cytosine. It's this nucleotide that exists right here within the region of DNA that binds NGFIA. And so what we simply did in this study was to take animals of different ages and to say, when does the difference in that methylation occur? Well, it isn't occurring before they're born, because at that particular point in time, it doesn't matter whether you take hippocampal cells from animals that were born to higher, that are gestated by higher hippocampal mothers, they do not contain that methyl mark. Shortly after birth, the methyl mark is attached to the cytosine, and that occurs in the offspring that are born to both high and low-looking mothers. In the offspring of low-looking mothers, the methylation mark is attached and remains affixed to that cytosine. In the animals that are born to high-looking mother, the methyl mark is actively removed. And it's removed through the binding of NGFIA. It is the binding of NGFIA to the site that causes the methyl mark to be actively removed. And so in essence, what you're looking at here then is a story through which the mother's behavior is shaping the chemical signals that are superimposed on the DNA, and in doing so, giving rise to a change in gene expression, the activity of the glucocorticoid receptor, as well as changes, of course, in the way the animal responds to stress. So the second part of what I want to talk to you briefly about is a question, very simply, as to whether or not a similar process might be occurring in human subjects. And the way we tested this by, again, working in collaboration, and this time with Gustavo Turecki and Moishe Ziff at McGill, and what we were doing here was to say, okay, look, we know we're not going to be able to do studies as definitively in humans as we can do in the rat, but perhaps what we can do is to come up with some approximations. So let's start by working at least with the same brain tissue. This is hippocampal brain tissue that comes from what is known as the Quebec suicide brain bank. And tragically, this brain bank is formed by donations of individuals who have died of suicide or have died through involuntary but no less sudden manner. So you now have access to tissues that are biochemically intact, which you can start to study. You also know, or you would assume, that since some of these individuals died involuntarily and others through their own means, that there might be some difference in terms of underlying psychopathology here. And that, in fact, is actually buttressed by the activities of Gustavo, whose team conducts what's known as forensic phenotyping. Essentially, what they do is they interview family members of the victims. And through the interviews with family members and friends, they are able to judge not only the history of psychopathology of the individual, but to also characterize their developmental history as well. The second thing that you can do is you can say, well, I'm going to look at the same region of the DNA that I studied in the rat, because of the work of Jonathan Turner and Claude Lillard at the University Leslie and Luxembourg, they've characterized the same region of the genome in the human that we had previously characterized in the rat. So what we're doing then is to excise hippocampal tissue from suicide victims of control, and we're looking at the comparable region of the genome. We're looking at the glucocorticoid receptor. In particular, we're interested in that region of the DNA that regulates the activity of the glucocorticoid receptor. And in the human, the promoter that is comparable to this 1-7 promoter that activates the glucocorticoid receptor in brain cells is known as this 1F promoter right here. And it also contains a sequence that can bind to NGFIA. So it operates very similar to the way it does in the rat. So the first thing we did when we looked at these brains was to characterize possible differences in glucocorticoid receptor levels. And what we found was that in hippocampus that came from controls, they produced more of this glucocorticoid receptor gene than did the individuals who died from suicide. We also found that this 1F promoter was more active in hippocampal samples from control versus suicide, as you would expect. So the regulatory region is more active, and the gene is producing more glucocorticoid receptors. And that difference was apparent in individuals who completed suicide versus controls. But then because of Gustavo's forensic phenotyping, we were then able to take this suicide group and to break them into two subpopulations. One suicide group were positive for a history of abuse in childhood. That contained included severe emotional neglect, physical and spoiler, sexual abuse. The other group was negative for this developmental history. And what you can easily see from this graph is that yes, indeed, it was only those individuals who were positive for abuse that showed the differences in the glucocorticoid receptor as well as in the differences in this exon 1F, this promoter organ activity. What we then did, of course, was to look at the methylation of this region. And we found, again, that indeed those individuals who were positive for a history of abuse had an increase in the methylation signal comparable to what we had seen in offspring reared by low-linking mothers. You'll note that neither in terms of methylation nor in terms of the production of the glucocorticoid receptor was there any difference between suicides negative for abuse and controls. And we then went on to show that the difference in methylation occurs at a very particular site, and that indeed, as in the rat, it is associated with a blockade in the ability of NGFIA to drive the glucocorticoid receptor. So the history of childhood adversity in these circumstances was associated with a change in the methylation status of this gene and a difference in the activity of the gene itself. So again, this is certainly not convincing by any means that the comparable processes are occurring, nor is it illuminate the mechanism by which human parenting might directly lead to these, but it is a story that is logically consistent with what we're seeing in the lab. And of course, one of the major features of all of this when we go through is that these basic fundamental biological features of parent interactions and activity of gene expression seem to be a theme that runs across multiple species. Okay, and I think at that point I will leave you and take any questions that you may have. Thank you very much.
Wow.
There's 100 more slides, so I show the person.
Walk to a divorce. I have to say that 4 or 5 years ago when I started talking about the relationship between socioeconomic deprivation and ill health, and talking about the way the brain was structured and so on, had a real sense that, well, folk thought was slightly daft, that it was maybe a step too far. I mean, the science has gone so much further, where we're not just looking at if the brain is structured, but we're looking at the actual genetics and so on of how it's done. Very good. Questions?
Sorry, I mean, it's an excellent and obvious, highly relevant question in our own context, and that is that if the question was, if you looked at the father, for example, could the father exert these same influences? In the context of the human studies, which I just recently described, the father was very commonly a source of variation, that is, a source of the abuse or the emotional neglect. So that I think in the human context, there's little doubt that this could occur. When you look at all that we know about child development under conditions of adversity, for both good and bad, out in terms of health outcomes, the theme certainly seems to be that the father can play equally effective role. I think probably the most convincing evidence comes from studies of child development, like people like Sir Michael Rutter from King's College, who have shown, for example, that one of the major predictors of psychopathology is the loss of the mother in early life. That effect can be statistically eliminated completely depending upon the response of the father to these events. So the father is able to bear his own grief and tend to the emotional needs of the child. That completely eliminates this particular effect. I mean, I won't go through all the evidence, obviously, but I think that those findings in general suggest to us that yes, this influence can, in fact, in the humanist context, be exerted through mother and father. And probably even outside of that, if you start to look at sources of resilience amongst children living under conditions of adversity, where the relevant source of resilience, what explains the absence of psychopathology or circumstances where it might be expected, can even lie outside of the nuclear family to involve other relatives or the community itself, which I think is a rather optimistic scenario.
Something that's less appreciated.
appreciated and studied is, in fact, that animals with higher levels of glucocorticoids are more successful in socially navigating their way through aggressive encounters. Glucocorticoids promote the expression of submissive postures that constrain aggressive behavior from a dominant animal. So the bottom line here is that glucocorticoids help you fight infection, help you survive famine, and help you deal with conflict. What kind of environments might these be? High levels of pathogens, nutrient deprivation, environments. Absolutely. The other way, and this is, I think, perhaps even more impressive, is that the behavioral manifestations can be equally adaptive. This is work done by Richard Carlet in Montreal and by David Farrington in London. They both did basically the same study. They looked at impoverished environments with higher crime levels and said, who tends to do reasonably well in those environments? And they found that boys that were behaviorally inhibited or more fearful were more successful. That is, they avoided the temptation of getting involved in gangs, crime, they were more attentive of their parents' supervision, and they were less likely to get into trouble. So you're absolutely right. I think one of the things we're thinking about here is that when we rear kids in impoverished and particularly violent environments, we're biasing them towards a phenotypic pattern of development that leads to the same kind of outcomes. The question then becomes remarkably interesting when you start asking it not so much about the outcomes, but about the parenting styles that lead to those outcomes. Because if your whole scenario suggests that adversity leads to a certain form of parenting that enhances stress reactivity, then what is the question you ask about the way you deal with the parenting? And it becomes particularly critical, I think, for communal programs to really understand how parenting occurs within those particular contexts. Lest we bring a very middle class set of understanding to parenting under a very diversity of different type of development. And I don't have by any means the pretense to answer that question, but I think it's an important question to ask.
I'm wondering how generalizable is this plasticity? And I wonder if there's information in the soldiers who suffer from PTSD, how when either they haven't been conditioned either by upbringing or by military training to sustain a defensive reaction, or
how can that be modulated? Is there anything that would be useful, used for your studies to help Chinese soldiers who suffer from PTSD? Yeah. I mean, you put your finger right on this, and asking the critical question is, first of all, to what extent does the machinery, the molecular cellular machinery that gives rise to this process, to what extent is this active in an adult? To what extent could you take advantage of that plasticity to perhaps reverse the effects of adversity in early life, or to better perhaps condition individuals for the traumatic experiences that are inevitable in certain conditions such as warfare? The first question is, we can answer with some clarity. I mentioned to you that mother's licking behavior actively remodels the methylation signal on the genome during the first period of life. It causes a methylation group to be removed. That same effect can occur in an adult rat. So we know the cells have the ability to do it, at least the rat brain cell. And no reason to think that's not true of the human brain cell as well. We know some of the work, this is a young fellow who works in McGill, has done studies to show that if you take animals who are raised by lowly neurons, and then you put them in an enriched environment, then you can reverse some of these epigenetic signals. So in theory, we know that in an adult animal, at least, you can remodel that epigenetic. Then you take to the obvious question. You take that knowledge, you bring it to a set of circumstances in which it's practical and therapeutic development. And we're just getting to the point of being able to do that. I would think the interesting thing was, Harry, well, 5 years ago when you were talking about social and economic forces being able to shape biology, social signals. And I suspect we experienced a certain level of reticence from both sides. This is very new. And only now are we even starting to turn around into human populations and ask the question, are there epigenetic signals that might be relevant either for suffering that derives from experience of warfare, or even more complex such, in risk factors that we determine who develops PTSD in this time. So all I can tell you is we've done this, we're in the midst of a study right now with a collaboration with a researcher in New York City named Rachel Yehuda. Rachel has been studying PTSD specifically. She's been looking at the ability of PTSD to cross generations, or at least the risk of PTSD, to go from mother and father to the offspring. And so the simple story here is that if the parents suffer from PTSD, it interferes with their parenting, and their children are likely to develop PTSD. So what we've done is we've taken blood samples from subjects who are the offspring of parents who have PTSD with their mom. And obviously here we don't take brain cells. We're using only a population of cells that we can derive from the blood. We're looking at the same gene, the glucocorticoid receptor, and we're finding differences as a function of the risk for PTSD. Now, in many ways, we can think of the dissatisfaction of these particular type of studies because you're not looking at brain. You're only looking at one small region of the genome where you know that the risk for PTSD is incredibly complex. You could simply be looking at something that is a proxy that predicts the risk for PTSD, but if you therapeutically change it, you wouldn't do anything. So I'm afraid we're really just starting to get to the point where we can really mobilize the level of science and address the question that everything you suggested is entirely possible.
Partly answered my question, which is
it's
really about the concept of critical period,
yes,
during which these effects are most predictable and others very long, you think it's long and too long. But I was also interested in perhaps the end result of these upstream influences on what you can ask for which chronic disease is, and things that are drawn into your
Let me give you a quick response to the issue of critical. So here's a bit of a different response, and not for a second do I claim I'm right. No, we really don't. I'm just going to give you a little bit of a different take on it. I have a running debate with a good friend of mine, Tao Hench, who's at Harvard, who studies critical periods in the development of the visual system, and who's a fabulous scientist. And he and many others have a very strong argument today that for this population of brain cells in this region of the cortex, there are critical periods where a particular event must occur. If it doesn't occur, then it's forever lost. Turns out, it's actually not so critical. And so now you hear people saying, well, it's a period of sensitivity. So I'm going to give you the other extreme. I'm going to suggest that in areas like the limbic brain, those that are responsive to stress, that this doesn't have a critical period. That in fact, the cellular events that I described to you that are associated with neural learning, they can occur at any time. And if they do, they'll produce the same effect. That's a bit of a radical thought, but we actually have some evidence for it. So, for example, to go back to the question that was asked earlier, we can take this NGFIA, we can genetically engineer animals who overproduce NGFIA in alpha. What we do, they show the same thing with us. That's an interesting part, and it goes back again to the question that you raised, because of course the exposure to trauma changes the way you are. It changes us in every dimension. It changes our physical, mental health totally. And so clearly some kind of major programming is occurring there. Somehow cells have to be able to undergo, at least in some areas, the ability to change these epigenetic. There's another way to think about what it might be about infancy that makes it critical. We know that for any of us with raised children, that when they're this big, right, that they're subject to a limited amount of influence. Us, right? Granny, aunt, baby, etc. That's pretty much it. The world is fairly small. So for us to continuously define a constant environmental experience for a child is possible. Then they go to school. And then they start finding out that other kids have other ways of doing things. And the sphere of influence becomes more complex. Our ability to regulate their environment becomes less and less as they go to adulthood, perhaps not existent. So I think what might be critical about this with respect to motor infant or parent infant interaction is the context in which it occurs. That when it occurs within that nuclear framework, or slightly extended framework, there is the capacity to engineer an environment that is consistent along with one or the other. And that later on is the cacophony of expense that really, if you will, masks it so you don't see those effects. That's just another take on the same problem. I mean, you know what, if that is just 5% right, then it's an interesting thought. And I don't doubt there are really critical and sensitive periods. But I think I take it with the previous question, which is so clinically relevant, as well as what we see in changes in children occurring at later stages of the period, for instance, I think to some extent we might want to move away from the critical period idea right to some extent. Now, you had a second question.
Yes,
you did.
You did.
And that was.
Like chronic diseases, which one do you think is most relevant?
Okay, so I knew one of the reasons I was keen on that question is that I had a slide. So I told you, I told you about the effect of altered stress reactivity as a function of maternal care and neglect. One of the questions we really went with was exactly the question that Harry was referring to earlier. And that was, does Harry's question make sense? Which we had always suspected that it did. That is, could the social forces that are regulated directly by social and economic events, that is the function of the family, can they explain the chronic illnesses that we see? And so what we've done in the rat is not only look at stress reactivity, we've looked at a wide range of phenotypes. And so here are those phenotypes which we've published rather extensively in some cases that are altered by maternal care. I showed you stress reactivity, cognitive development. I have to do this. This is wretched of me. And I'm not promoting me, by the way. This is the work of a postdoc, Daniel Champagne. This is a hippocampal brain cell that was taken from an animal reared by a high-looking mother. This is the same type of brain cell taken from an animal, an adult animal raised by a low-looking mother. In blue, you see what many of you will identify as the dendrites. In yellow are the axons. And what you'll immediately note is that animals that are reared by a high-looking mother have many more of these dendrites. The physical shape of brain cells within the prefrontal cortex and the hippocampus is regulated by genes that are themselves regulated by maternal care. So cognitive development is subject to regulation by maternal care and neglect. And I'll leave it at that. So too is obesity. The female and male offspring of low-looking mothers by 5 to 6 months of age are way 40% more than the offspring of high-looking mothers. Their metabolic function, their insulin sensitivity is regulated through maternal care. And sexual development, including the timing of puberty in females, is regulated by maternal care. And those of you who work on puberty or work on poverty will know that every one of these aspects is subject to the regulation by socioeconomic events. So the point we are trying to make here is that at least in this animal model, is that each of these developmental outcomes, which we associate with socioeconomic diversity, can be directly regulated by the quality of parental care. I got more slides.
Yes.
So, what happens next year?
Yes, absolutely. And I warned you. But you've asked the critical question. And yes, the great female rat nightmare comes true. They become their mothers. So if you take female rat pups that were reared by high-looking mothers, that when they become lactating mothers, they too are high-looking mothers. And females reared by low-looking mothers tend to be low-looking mothers. And the reason for that is very much the same, or parallels the reasons that we spoke about in terms of stress reactivity. So, yes, you can cross-foster and show, for example, that if you take a female pup that was born to a high-looking mother and have a reared by a low-looking mother, that as an adult, she becomes a low-looking mother, so we know that it is the mother's behavior that's driving us. Essentially, there's a particular gene that produces a protein known as the estrogen receptor, or an estrogen receptor. And when it's activated in the brain region known as the neoperioptic area, it triggers this whole maternal awakening movement. And that, the regulation of this estrogen receptor is a function of the amount of licking that the female received in infancy. So females that were licked more produce more of this estrogen receptor, and when they become lactating mothers, they get licked more in their pups. And the difference in the activity of this gene is also associated with DNA formation. So all things remaining equal, you bias towards a transgenerational effect. Okay. Now, if things don't remain equal, you can move it in both directions. And this was a study that was done by Francis Champagne, who is now a professor at Columbia University, who did completed PhD studies in our group. Francis asked the question, and it's a critical one, is could you move the behavior of the high or low-looking mother by altering the quality of the environment during her pregnancy or during at some other point in her adult life? And so what Frances did in the initial study was she took mothers and she characterized them with their first litter as being high or low-looking mothers. Okay? So she knows now whether this adult female is a high-looking mother or a low-looking mother. She then rebred the females. And for half of the animals in each group, they were exposed to stress during gestation, chronic stress, 3 hours of stress per day. And what she found was that the stress altered the licking behavior of females who were otherwise high-licking mothers. So this is the licking behavior of the high-licking mothers who experienced gestation during control conditions. When they gave birth, they once again became high-licking mothers. However, if the high-licking mother was stressed, she now licked her pups at a level that was indistinguishable from low-licking pups. And the female offspring reared by that mother were indistinguishable from the female offspring reared by low-licking pups. So you can move it in this direction. Francis also showed in a later study that if you take the low-licking females and expose them to environmental enrichment, which gives them a far more pleasant environment, that they then become high-licking mothers and their offspring. So I think you put your finger absolutely on what might be, if anything, is relevant for intervention programs in this context to suggest that these forms of parenting are vulnerable to environmental events and can be moved in either particular direction quite predictably, which goes back, of course, to the question of it being adaptive. Because if you took a mother who was in a high-quality environment and moved her to a low-quality would then bias the environment would then presumably favor more stress reactive. Which of course is the genius of epigenetic variation to begin with, because the last thing you want to do is to find yourself in a new environment with new demands, sitting around going, well, I've got to wait for a gene or two to mutate before I can produce a difference in phenotype, right? Better to allow the environment to operate directly on the gene and produce this
give advice on a public health basis as to how all this experimental work could be translated into action which might affect the very high incidence of drug abuse, anxiety, diabetes, heart disease and obesity that was afflicting this purely hypothetical North European country of 5.5 million people.
That's what we're talking about over a low alcohol lager,
how can this be translated into practical medical public health policy?
Well, I will speculate, but I will do so with some humility. I think it goes back to the question in the dialogue we had right from the beginning. I think if I were an individual, and I'm sure many of you are, who are operative within that particular hypothetical, you probably sat here and thought, well, you know, all of this is modestly entertaining, but modestly entertaining description of the biology that describes a reality I've been seeing for years. You can walk out of here, and I hoped to have left you with a little bit of something you didn't know, but that has a lot more to do with epigenetics than I'm afraid it does to do with social commentary, because the social commentary you knew. What I've done, this field has the hope of doing, is to, I think, come to some of the questions that you've raised before, to some extent, and that is to create biological reality around what we know is occurring from our clinical and social and psychological observations. That said, I think the word resilience speaks directly to your particular question. And I'll start with probably the person who I think in modern literature kicked off this, and that's Amy Winer, who was a developmental psychologist working in Hawaii back in the 1960s, earlier than that, I think, in fact, working with high-risk children. And this may come as a surprise to you, but Hawaii has a profile that is very, very consistent with the impoverished setting. Try to imagine that for a moment, but it's true. Lots of exactly the problems that you referred to. In exactly the problems you referred to. So her question was, well, if I look at high-risk families, I mean, I know the families in which these diseases are prevalent. If I look at high-risk families, what predicts a child who comes from that environment and doesn't show obesity, doesn't show, shows success within an academic environment, and shows adjustment with respect to dealing with the social and emotional demands of life? And that gets to the issue that we spoke of earlier. It turns out that it is a very positive and stable force operating within the family, but could be of communal origin. So it could be a grandparent, it could be an aunt, an uncle, it could be any major stable force that is integrated within the operation of the family and is consistently there and present for the developing child. And there are a number of programs then, I think of James Olds' programs in the United States, in which he's built upon those particular models in the Elmira studies and the studies he's done in Alabama and Kansas, in which he's brought people into the homes with nursing backgrounds in most cases, but not universally. These are people who are trained to work within the family, to bring some element of structure, to buttress, to deal some practical and logistical support. And those programs have had dramatic effects in terms of the incidence of accidents, criminality amongst the children. They haven't been studied with respect to the more fine-grained health issues that you've alluded to, but they're clearly consistent with that. So they seem, what seems to be a common theme here is that of a community-based organization that interacts with the family, in which the family serves as the intercept, if you will, between the community program and the child. And it is continuous, and it is stable, and it is there to work with the parent as much as a victim as it is the child. So the parents become a very logical target. Andrew and I were talking about a program that's been established by psychiatrist Jim Witziak in Vermont. And of course, there the scale is somewhat smaller, a program from which you might benefit in Scotland. Jim's approach is to deal with the parents in any particular case of child psychopathology, is to immediately identify the obstacles that might exist in the mental health and well-being of the parent, and to deal with the parents as much as a target as the child. That clearly takes a much more conservative approach to all of this, but it thinks of the family as the unit of operation within these particular programs. And I'm sorry if I'm doing a poor job of describing this, but I think that in a sense, that's, you know, all I've done is to describe a little biology that's certainly consistent with that particular
approach. It seems to me that the looking that you can describe, the human equivalent to that's attachment, the whole process of attachment between the child summarizes that looking behavior description. And we know that if you do an inventory of attachment behavior in, say, teenage girls, the more items of attachment behavior they can show, the lower their salivary cortisol levels are. The relationship between this ability to empathize and the stress response is inverse. If you're an empathizer, you're not a stressed individual. And for me, I think what I take out is things like the North Stanley Partnership and Triple B, positive parenting program and so on. They're already here in Scotland. But I think the challenge is to try and amplify the effort. And what's really interesting from what I've heard tonight is the focus on the much earlier part of development, antepartum, the enriched environment during pregnancy, where a mother's mental health might be very stressed by an abusive relationship and so on, needs to be much more aggressive, if that's the right word in this context, in identifying and dealing with it.
Yeah.
And, we need to work through what the options are. And I think enhancing the ability of a whole range of services to support pregnant women during a very difficult period.
I think there's two literatures that highlight exactly this, your approach. First, again, this goes back to metaphorically the question raised earlier. The work of Werner Weissman and others showing that the risk for depression is transmitted from parent to offspring, and that has to be in some cases contextual, because if you can successfully treat the depression of the mother, you greatly eliminate the risk for depression, drug abuse in the offspring. And I think the second piece of literature that is absolutely compelling on exactly the point that you've raised is a literature in the human population that's actually very well developed. And that is this whole issue of the influence of attachment on pubertal development in human females. And this is work by people like Jay Belsky and Bruce Ellis does a brilliant job of showing the way in which child attachment regulates pubertal development in the child. And there, very clearly, you're talking about a fundamental endocrine event. And that event and its timing is directly related to attachment, as are the risk, of course, for sexual promiscuity or early pregnancy when people start to commit themselves. But I think that literature in particular speaks directly to what you're saying, is that this is the real literature for multiple outcomes.
Okay. Well, for the best part of 2 hours, you've captivated an audience on DNA methylation, and I think that says so much for the quality of the science and the way you've presented it, and I think it's given us fascinating insights into the possibilities of applying some of these interventions in an environment that really needs something new brought to the table in terms of improving health. So, thanks very much for taking the time. We will benefit hugely from what you've described, and I'd like everyone to thank Michael.
Just before, there are some refreshments through in the room to our point to my left and my left. So join us and continue the discussion if you can. Many of you will realise that this is the first lecture in the 6 seminar series of the Glasgow Centre for Population Health. We're running the evaluation of the whole series at the moment. So for those of you who have taken part in that, thank you. For those of you who haven't, you still can by going to the website. The next seminar in the series is we've got Tim Jackson, who's Professor of Sustainable Development at the University of Surrey, who's going to come and talk about prosperity without growth. And again, many of you will know that Tim has written a report for the Sustainable Development Commission about this, and there's a book coming out, or has just come out as well, by that name. That's happening at 11 o'clock on the 26th of January. We're shifting the time because Tim can only pass through Glasgow on the way somewhere else, so we'll have to change the time. So that's at 11 o'clock for that one only. In the middle of February, the 16th of February, we have Eleanor Yule coming. Eleanor is an independent filmmaker with vast experience, including working for the BBC, BAFTA nominated, worked with Peter Mullen, Michael Palin, Christopher Lee, Peter Brook, to name but a few. And she's going to come give us an illustrated lecture about media portrayals of poverty. I'm really looking forward to that. And in March, we're continuing this theme of young people, if you like, and poverty. We've got a guy called Sudhir Venkatesh coming from the University of Columbia, where he's Professor of Sociology. Some of you may have seen Sudhir's work. He's a blogger on the Freakonomics website. But he's going to come and talk about law and order in the urban ghetto and the relevance of the underground economy for social policy, which is a big issue in Glasgow. Then, if that's not enough, we've got a guy called David Gustaf coming in April. David has been described by The Independent as one of the 100 people that makes it worth living in Britain, and he's been described as Britain's Barack Obama. So there's no pressure on David then at all. And he works for a kids' company where he's an educational motivator. So this is somebody who's come from a deprived urban circumstance through Oxford University and a conversion to Islam, and now works with other deprived children. So he's come to speak to us about moral responsibility in the young in April. And then in May 2010, I'm hoping we're going to have somebody come and speak about climate change and well-being. So you're welcome to all of those. Go to the website if you want the dates. And there are leaflets like this floating around this evening, so you can pick one up. Okay, thanks a lot.